This is the PubRight Podcast, a service of the Arbortex community.
Hello, and welcome to the PubRight Podcast. In this podcast, we're excited to be speaking with Barry Schaefer. Barry's a longtime HTML, XML expert consultant. He's part of the Gilbain team. His company, X Systems, was the first Arbortex partner, and we sold to Xi Enterprise before they, in turn, were purchased by SDL. His experience with publishing projects in nearly every industry makes his advice invaluable. He's been there, done that, and seen it all. Here we go.
I've been giving a little thought to what I could say that would have any value, and my career, of course, is completely fortuitous. I don't think I've ever planned anything in my life, and that has been the root of all kinds of evil. But also the root of some things that seem to turn out well, and that I think profited from. So I wanted to chat a little bit about that, kind of the juxtaposition early in my career of being in a major pre-database but element-oriented environment, and then finding myself right after that in a couple of text-oriented environments, kind of library science, document acquisition, cataloging, things like that. And it taught me the balance between, and the differences between element-oriented content and how you can deal with it, and text-oriented content and the differences in the way you have to approach it. And then maybe just take it from there. I guess my message for someone getting started is, don't forget the human side, the organizational side of what you're trying to do, because there's always been technology that was adequate to do what you wanted to do from, 40 years ago forward, but the challenges have typically been the mating of organizational structures, skill sets, management philosophies within an organization to the technology that ended up getting implemented, and that's usually where the horror stories come from. So I wanted to chat a bit about that. And
yeah, that actually reminds me. One of my favorite quote was something you said just at Gilbain last fall, and you said, your customers can hurt you more, but a bad team or a bad approach will hurt you faster.
Very true. Very true.
Yeah.
And of course, what we're seeing, and in fact, did a presentation for Idea Alliance, a webinar on it, and that is that that the customer has in a sense always been at the end of the development and planning line. You planned what you were going to do, you looked at the technology you had available, and then the customers got what you thought was appropriate for them. That has turned around completely now, and customers have the technology and are making the demands that really put them at the front of the planning and development cycle. What do they want? What will they accept? How are they going to deal with it? And that puts tremendous pressure, additional pressure on the team, on the developers, because you're now being told what to produce, but you're not necessarily being given the resources to produce it. And I think that switch is one of the biggest changes, I think, in the industry, in the information industry, that we have ever seen.
Wow. So how do writing teams, what are they supposed to do in
right.
that
what
now?
Yeah. What's worse, and we saw this in a project that I did with Gilbain last year, I guess it was late 2009, that is that we're seeing organizations that are subject matter related but not focused on writing all of a sudden becoming part of the information providing. It might be your legal department, it might be your regulatory department, it might be a whole series of departments that have owned information but have never been put in a position where they had to create that information in a specific format. So what you've got is an expansion of the writing or information creation world to include all kinds of people who don't view themselves as information providers. They view themselves as whatever they are, and that started actually in the 90s, and it's, I think, accelerated considerably because now the customer, for instance, doesn't just want to go and look something up on the internet. They want to go and get a license, which means that the license licensure department has to be able to put information out there in a format that the customer can read and understand, and then complete the license or whatever it is, permit, license, you name it, complete that transaction. And that put a lot of pressure. I've been in meetings where people like the legal department said, geez, we're lawyers. We write for a living, but we don't write to your format for a living, you know, and we don't have the people to do it. So that creates, you know, even more pressure because you've got people who don't think of themselves as doing what you want them to do.
Fascinating. Do you have some other examples of what's going on there? I mean, it's...
Well, sure. You know, that kind of thing creates a whole series of potential problems. For instance, and we ran into this in the project with the state government. Yeah, you can get something out there, and yeah, the governor and you know, administration really wants to have a very powerful web presence. And so you put all these transactions out there, you know, the kind of the citizens portal. If you want to do so-and-so, go here. If you want to do so-and-so, go there. And then puts information out that isn't really quite available, isn't really quite adequate to have, you know, all the people who are going to go there successfully complete the transaction. In some cases, they don't. And in some cases, for instance, a renewal of a driver's license or something that is time sensitive, they don't get it done, they get frustrated, they get stopped and get a ticket, and they call the governor and say, what's
wow.
going on? So what you've got is not only is the value of the information going up, but the consequences for failure of those transactions is going up as well. The customer suffers, but so does the developer who put the system out there, which really changes the I think the depth of analysis that you must be prepared to do to find out, okay, if I'm going to do X online, what's it going to take to make sure that all the people who go there can do X and do it successfully?
So you're seeing a lot of mismatches between what organizations are delivering and what their customer actually wants.
Exactly. The organization realizes that they don't have something that will work for the whole range of customers who are going to go there, and so they don't get anything up. And now it's next year, and gee, we're still talking about it. This state government that we worked with, they'd been grappling with this for 3 or 4 years, and had just not been able to do anything. Congressional Research Service that I did a project with back in 2006 and 2007. You know, they have 400 analysts who were producing these very, very high sensitivity analyses for Congress, and they'd been struggling, heavens, for at least 7 or 8 years, trying to keep up with what Congress wanted, trying to do things in a way that they could send over to the Hill, but also could put up on Thomas, you know, the interactive system that National Archives and Records maintains. And they're, you know, all over the government, there are things like that. And the problem we have is that, well, technology keeps getting better. The better technology is, to some extent, coming in through the consumer. You know, the consumer usually now is using smart technology, smartphones and iPods and iPads and you name it, that are more powerful and, in many cases, more flexible than what the providers have.
So that's a battle that is hard to fight. Right, especially for a large organization, you spend a lot of, if you're lucky, you've spent a lot of time doing analysis of what your customer wants to have and how they're going to get at it, and then something changes in the middle. Are you finding, you know, what kind of advice can you give for that?
Well, I think obviously for a quantum shift that comes out of nowhere, and you know, we have seen a few of those. There really isn't much that you can do other than not overreaching. You know, there is a, when you go into a project and you begin doing the requirements analysis, there's a real temptation to get ahead of yourself, to begin designing before you really know what your, you know, what your customer base looks like, before you really know what your provider base looks like. You know, do you have organizations you are going to be asking for information in a certain format that simply don't have the staff or the funding to do that? And so I think that foundation of knowing the environment that you're in before you attempt any change, and then attempting the changes, and this has been part of the development technique world for a long time, and that is, if you're going to make changes that are significant, make them in small doses. Don't try to rewrite and redo your entire environment in one shot, because you are creating a three-legged stool that has so many legs on it that, any one of those can knock the stool over, and we've seen that happen. And the other, I think, thing that's, that I've been in some just incredible meetings with clients where the IT folks, who usually are the center of, the content-related folks, have to go to IT to get the resources. And so many times, IT kind of takes over a little bit because, they have a very mature set of techniques, and they run the computer facilities, and so, they tend to set, set the pace. And I've seen situations, large ones, where that happens, things get designed, and then fairly late, the content providers get called in to say, well, this is what we're going to need from you. And I've been in meetings where the content provider vice president said, not only no, but heck no, we're not going to do that. Are you kidding? The whole thing went in the cock tap. And, these are big organizations, big companies that whose names you would know if I told you, that simply didn't understand the changing nature, kind of the changing landscape of how the different components of the information life cycle relate to one another. It's doable. I mean, we've certainly seen some great successes, and there are great successes all the time, but they're usually based on a thorough and almost non-technical analysis of the landscape that they're facing. Who are their people? Who are their customers? What do they look like? What do they expect? And based on that, then some negotiation almost, and I use the term negotiation not in the formal sense, but kind of in the sense that the components have to sit down and decide and agree on what they can possibly do. One of the things you see a lot in organizations is that from somewhere up in the executive suite, a relatively, or what turns out to be an arbitrary deadline gets set. We have to get this up by next June. Well, that may be okay. You may be able to do that, but you may not. And trying to meet an unreachable deadline is worse than meeting no deadline at all, because what happens is, the whole thing turns into a circus. And in some cases, you end up in worse shape than you were before you even started the effort. So reaching a consensus on what can be done when, on what the roles are, and are the people who are supposed to play those roles comfortable with it. I did some work out at U.S. Pharmacopeia a number of years ago where they had, these are the folks who write drug information. And they had pharmacologists who were their writing team. Many of those pharmacologists were outside the organization, and some of them, they had one fellow who was one of the world great authorities on pharmacology, who said, I don't use those computer things. I write my stuff. He wrote all of his stuff double-spaced on yellow pads, and when he needed to change it, he scratched it out and wrote in the blank spaces. Drove them nuts because they had to get his stuff up, and they said, well, how are we going to revise it? He said, you just print me out something, and I'll mark it up for you, and I'll send it back. Drove him nuts, but it was an environment in which he was not an interchangeable piece of the landscape. They had to use him. I've been with legal publishers who were in the same situation. Many of their writers were judges, attorneys, legislators, people who had unique expertise and who didn't feel at all responsible to meet anybody's procedures as to what they were to do. As a matter of fact, many of them had old systems. And, I use WordPerfect. Well, I know, but we want Word. Well, I'm sorry, I use WordPerfect. Those are the kinds of things that, if ignored in the beginning, can become huge problems as the effort continues.
Wow. That's just, I don't know what to say about that.
But nobody talks about that. Nobody is going to get up, unless you're inside the organization and, being a consultant and then, before that, the 16 years with X Systems, being the software vendor and in some cases the design support folks, you got a chance to see that. But Organizations don't talk about that kind of thing outside much, because nobody who makes those kinds of mistakes wants to stand up and says and say, "Shoot me, I did this." You know, it cost us. Well, in back in the 90s, it's a fairly famous case. The Wall Street Journal spent $22 million on a new system and ended up having to throw it away completely. Actually, they never even got the system built. They spent $22 million on the design of a new system, and because they hadn't taken a whole series of things into account, they ended up, the whole thing went down the drain. And it was, you know, that did get reported because, the journal is a very prominent publication, but you don't see a lot of that. If you don't get that going in, once things get out of hand, then all people want to do is paper it over or put it under the rug or just get through it. And so it's important to be circumspect going in. And the other thing that happens is, you can go to a writing group, especially an information provider, an information owner, and get them to do a lot of things. But once you confront them with something that they view as seriously confrontational or damaging, they tend to go up the walls. And by the time that they do that, it can take months to get them down. I've been with a couple of government agencies who said, "Oh, yeah, well, XML, we're not sure we want to do XML because we had a bad experience with that several years ago. And boy, our people, if you mention XML, they get up and walk out of the room." Well, it turned out that they had bought a product that wasn't adequate and had put that product out with no training, and of course it was a debacle, and people remembered that, and so that was the environment in which they were trying to move forward, and they had been mandated to do XML, and their people were just screaming and yelling about it. They didn't want to do it. They had people leaving for no reason other than the fact that they hadn't handled that change correctly.
Wow. Yes, you're right. Nobody talks really about this. The last year or so, I've heard a couple of more stories than the normal none, but they're all about, they usually only talk about inside tech pubs, getting the writers to change the way that they're working, like into topic-based or just to thinking differently, separating form from content.
Sure.
But nobody talks about talking to the rest of your organization and looking at content production as a whole.
Well, I think you're right, and of course the change in committed writing started back in the 80s, really, when SGML was first picked up by the Department of Defense, when SGML wormed its way into the ATA, the commercial airplane air traffic world. So we've got a lot of experience with getting writers who are paid to be writers to change what they do, and partly that's true because that's what they are. They're paid to be writers. They don't have a job if they're not willing to do the things that the organization requires them to do. Now, you can push it too far. I worked with one legal publisher who had run out of money in the 80s and had people doing SGML with a line editor, simple editor, not even a word processor, and a book of codes. They said, "Oh, here, you have to write your stories every day, but just put the codes in and don't make any mistakes." Well, you can imagine what that was like. And it was created a horrible situation. But I think what we have to say today now is that the boundaries around the fence around tech pubs or the fence around pubs has broken down, and the entire organization is now vulnerable to becoming part of the information providing. And we haven't been prepared for that. And a lot of organizations aren't prepared for it, and a lot of IT folks get really upset when you start talking to subject matter groups who don't, who break every rule and won't change and can't do things right. There are three problems that you've got, or there are three situations you can have in an environment like this. One is that you go to people and they do what you ask. Mm-hmm. The other is, the second is that you go to them and they refuse. The third, and in some cases the most damaging, is you go to them, they say, "Yeah, we'll do it," but then they do it 60% of the time, which means you get to read everything they do and fix it. And that can be, that can be significant. In some cases, worse than having to fight the battle of why won't you do it, what can we do to help you. All of these things are there, and they're getting worse because the public, the consuming public, is using devices that make it easier and easier for them to want information of all types at all times. They want to do transactions at all times. They want to find information. They want to do searches. You name it. And it's growing exponentially simply because technology is coming into the marketplace exponentially. And the information world has not seen that before and is really not handling it very well when you get right down to the body of it.
I couldn't agree more.
Wow. But it's doable. It is doable. There is a company in D.C. that you probably know something about, the Bureau of National Affairs, that started this back in the early 90s. They're really kind of a poster child for doing it right, and they did all kinds of things that I think, even though the technology has changed, the techniques are very relevant. For instance, one of the things they did was bring their authoring groups in. And by the way, they had 800 authors of different disciplines writing 200 information products, and these folks were guild. They were unionized, which means that if the company stepped out of line, they'd get a grievance, and they did get a couple. But they brought them in and made presentations to many of the groups to say, this is what we want, this is what we will expect of you, but you know, we're going to make it very easy for you, here's what we're going to be doing for you. They set up an authoring lab where they could bring people in and show them, bring the writers in, groups of two or three, and show them some of the new ideas that they had. And the writers, and once they calmed down, had great ideas. And then they gave every group that was brought online, they said, you have 3 months during which time you can use the old system if you want. We'd just like you to write one piece, maybe a week. And we'll create the necessary, spend the necessary money and get the necessary software to convert your old stuff to the new format for you. And it took usually about 30 days, and the authors had would switch over. They did all kinds of things like that because they recognized that they were facing a very implacable situation, and many of these writers were people who are absolutely irreplaceable. I mean, political writers, economics writers. Well, couldn't, if they left, you couldn't replace them very easily. So, and son of a gun, they have a system that is still HTML, as a matter of fact, because they haven't moved to XML for all of it yet. They're working on that. But it does everything they want, and all their writers use it, including their 250 or so correspondents around the world. And I think those kinds of illustrations, and this company has had groups from all over the world come and see what they're doing, including, by the way, Mike Iantosca from IBM and some of his guys. Before they developed DITA, they sat down with BNA to see, well, how are you guys doing? This was back in the 90s, late 90s. And so I think the information is there, but it's really a matter of kind of clearing one's head, getting one's wits about them, and saying, what can we really hope to do here, and what are the limits that we're facing?
Wow, I had no idea that there was that connection between BNA and the DITA team earlier.
Well, it's not an official one, because obviously they're in different areas, but I was there. I was in those meetings when Mike and his team came down, and I know they walked out with some valuable information. I'm sure IBM would say, oh, no, we designed it. And they did. I mean, it was really a different environment.
Oh, absolutely.
They learned some things there, I believe, that helped them to come up with what they did internally. And they've had all kinds of people. They even have their competitors come in because they're very open, employee-oriented firm. I've written a couple articles about them, and because they are kind of still unique, even though they've been doing this for quite a long time.
Maybe you can send us some links to your articles so that we can post that along with the podcast.
Yeah, I can certainly do that. There's an interesting technique or interesting development protocol that came out of the UK. It's called Soft Systems Methodology, SMS, mm-hmm. or SSM, developed by a fellow, Peter Checkland, at one of the universities. And it essentially what it says is, the system is not the computers. The system is the entire context in which the effort is being done. And here are a whole set of techniques on how you get out all of those things, the relationships among people, who affects whom. And it gets a little detailed in some ways, I guess, as the Brits sometimes want to do. But there are some very, very powerful concepts in there of, there's the virtual system and the real system and stuff like that. And I think we we need a little of that. We need to step back a little and say, you know, we do not live in it. We may be thinking technology-centered because technology is so elegant and so brilliant, but we don't live in a technology-centered information world. Nothing has changed much in the sense that it's still the information is still the product of rational human thought. And how we, you know, how we put that through the sausage machine changes because the sausage machine changes. But all of the basic concepts are still in place. And as a matter of fact, now the technology is getting so demanding, they're becoming even more important because technology is moving at a speed that the information provider community has lost control of completely. And it's going to probably be playing catch up for the next generation, I would think.
Absolutely. Well, we kind of went right into conversation and didn't get to hear about you, Barry. Tell us about your history. What are you doing?
Well, there's not a whole lot to tell. I find it amusing but a little scary that I most meetings I'm in now I'm the oldest guy there. But I got into this business absolutely by accident. Finally a couple of years late got out of college in early '65 and. And I think it's probably still the case, a 24-year-old with a degree in psychology, a bachelor's in psychology, doesn't get a lot of job offers. I got two. I got an offer to be a deputy probation officer for Orange County, California, where I lived. And a friend of mine said, you know, you ought to go down and talk to the telephone company because they have a management training program, and doesn't matter what your degree is, if you're pretty high in your class, you know, they'll put you where they want. So I went down to San Diego and interviewed with all the different departments that they had, and they came back to me about a week later and said, well, we like you, and we'd like to offer you a job, and we'd like to put you in our revenue accounting department. I gulped and said, gee, I never took an accounting course. Are you sure that would be right? And they said, no, it's our computerized billing department, and it's mostly personnel management. So I took that job. I worked for a year in a billing office that was, if you can imagine, 7 men and 450 women. and even for a 24-year-old, that was terrifying. But after a year of that, the fellow who ran the office said, you know, as you can see, this is a department that's not really going anywhere. I mean, we're getting new computers and things like that, but there's not much of a... future moving up in management. So I'm going to try to get the two of you, there were two of us doing the same thing, transfer to headquarters and get you on a really good project. So he made some calls, and one of the vice presidents said, hey, well, we're automating the white page directories. Why don't you send that one kid, Schaefer, up, and we'll put him in this project. So they did. I ended up in early '66 working on their white page directories, which got me into publishing. And taught me, this was the pre-database days, you know, where you, as a matter of fact, the mainframes we were working on had all tape. We didn't even have disk. You wrote your records, you wrote your programs, and then, you passed the files from one program to another via, we had master files that were 30 and 40 reels of tape. Did that for a while and learned an awful lot about element-oriented content, because a directory tends to be that. It's that strange, you know, it ends up getting typeset like text, but it really is element-oriented. When they decided they wanted to send me to Bell Labs in New Jersey, I quit, went back to Los Angeles, and went to work for Xerox Education Division, and got involved in real text, and we were a bibliographics division, and I was the operation manager, and I ran a group that was producing some of the industry's first true computerized book catalog. I also ran the cataloging group, and so I learned a lot about text in that environment, and I didn't even know it at the time, but what that was showing me was the difference between the way kind of the IT or data processing world deals with content, element-oriented content, and the way the library or bibliographics, what we would now call, I guess, content world deals with it. And from there, stayed with Xerox for a while, then went to work for a company in Southern California that had a very large division doing tech pubs. And it was interesting because that division was run by the two guys who had built the RCA graphics division in Dayton, New Jersey, Phil Haynes and Don Seymour. So we had all of the RCA, they had a very high performance photo typesetting system, and they had programming languages, and I was there for a year or so, and then founded my own firm, a partnership with a fellow, and we did publications we did phone directories. We did the country's first thoroughbred bloodstock catalog, the first dog show catalog, electronically, and sold that to Bell South in '68, and went to work for a planning research corporation in a big graphics division. So I found myself, staying in the publishing world. I did a lot of work in tech pubs, worked with the Navy and Air Force. In 1980, they were going to sell the division and offered me a chance to either go with it or to come to D.C. where they were headquartered and see if I could find work with the company, which I ended up doing. As a matter of fact, I had met my wife, and she was working in their D.C. headquarters, so that was really no decision that was coming. Stayed with them for a while. I had a chance to run the White House Computer Center, which was fun. Ran cataloging and the document acquisition for NASA as a contractor for a while, and I spent a year and a half with U.S. News and World Report in their manufacturing side. So that meeting in Orange, California, in '65, where the fellow said, we'll find a way to get you into something important, really kind of changed my life, and I didn't even see it coming. We founded X Systems in 93, and it was acquired by Sly Enterprise before it was acquired in 2008. And I've had a chance to just do some really interesting stuff. We built software. We were Arbortext's first major development partner, started back in 93, and I've had a great time. I met one of the fellows I worked with in California in '65, in the mid 2000s. He had stayed with the Bell system, and I had, of course, gone off and done everything I could think of. And he looked at me, and he was having five martinis for lunch. He was just a tiny bit paunchy, wore the three-piece suit with the gray vest, and I thought, that would have been me if I'd stayed there. And so I've been incredibly blessed to have a career that never had a bored moment. And that's kind of where I get to this point. I'm semi-retired. My wife keeps saying I ought to retire completely, and I keep telling her I don't know what that means. So we live in Virginia and have since I moved there in 1980, and we live in Central Virginia. And so having a wonderful time doing things like this and trying to contribute. People like me and Ray Stachowiak, who I actually met when I worked for Datalogix back in the early 80s. Have become the old graybeards of the industry, and hoping to contribute some of that as we move into this brave new world of technology.
Fantastic! You've been a fabulous interview. I have been laughing and just amazed the whole time.
Well, I'm thank you. I appreciate that. In terms of to finish the kind of the description of where we are with technology, I had an interesting and again another fortuitous happening in when I went to work for the telephone company. I was in the computer room one day, and it was a huge computer room. They had a whole bunch of machines because at that time they were just switching over from a punched card system, and they had sorters and collators and everything you can think of. And there was a desk, and I opened the desk drawer, and in there was an IBM manual from 1934 that said, this is how you develop a billing system using a key punch and a card gauge, which is just a thin metal stick that you can put through card holes. And so I opened it and thought, what the heck is this? I read through it, and here was in the 30s with the most rudimentary technology you can imagine, if you could even call it technology, a way of doing a whole billing system. And And one of the things that occurred to me then, and it has come back to me over and over, is that technology does not make it possible for us to do things. It simply makes it possible for us to do things faster and sometimes better. But it's really that that very reasoned thought that goes into developing a system at the level of technology that's available that creates successes. And I think that's a lesson that I think was well spent on me, because I've seen it over and over again. The growth of technology cannot make up for a lack of reasoned thought in design. And unfortunately, I think we're kind of falling to some extent victim to that.
What a perfect way to end. Thank you, Barry. This is fantastic.
Well, Lynn, that's my wife's name. Sorry. Elizabeth, it's always a pleasure.
The PubRight Podcast is a production of Single Sourcing Solutions in San Jose, California. Copyright 2009. Single Sourcing Solutions.